The Pope's on tour.
Oh, Johnny boy, the pipes are coming.
The Celtic rock band The Pope's are just one provocative tweak of Catholic tradition. But go to a mass in the African nation of Zambia and hear another one. The Pope lands in Africa today. The fastest-growing Catholic population speaks in its own voices, but is increasingly leading global Catholic identity. The center of Mass in Africa on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, March 17th. Happy St. Paddy's. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea, in for Adora Udoji, who's on leave with her baby. This morning, we'll discuss the implementation of Islamic religious law in Pakistan's Swat Valley. That begins this week. And we're also going to look at the high number of autism cases among a group of Somali immigrants living in Minneapolis. We'll also look ahead to the Pope's arrival in Africa today. All this and more ahead, but first, these headlines.
$165 million worth of congressional backlash over AIG's bonuses.
These executive bonuses are beyond even outrageous. I don't know what a term is that is more definitive than outrageous, but outrageous does the trick. These bonuses being paid were outrageous.
Outrageous. Did you get that? Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said there's no way AIG should have paid the bonuses. And President Obama is trying to recover the money by placing restrictions on a $30 billion installment of bailout funds scheduled to go out to AIG. You can expect to hear more insults hurled AIG's way today. Congress is holding two hearings focusing on the insurance industry. Senate panel will look into whether insurance companies should be regulated by state or the federal government, while a House committee examines systemic risk in the financial industry with an eye toward allowing companies to grow too big to fail.
Yes, it is St. Patrick's Day as well. I am rumored to be part Irish. Who knows? You know, we're all American mutts. Anyway, President Obama is going to speak to the Irish Prime Minister Brian Cowen at the White House. He's also going to talk with two leaders from Northern Ireland. They will discuss the need to maintain peace there despite recent violence. And overseas, Pope Benedict is set to arrive in Cameroon later this morning. He'll also visit Angola during his week-long visit. He's due to explain why the Catholic Church says abstinence is the best way to prevent AIDS. On the papal plane, he said condoms are not the answer in the fight against AIDS. And North Korea is fully reopening its border with the South. That allows in South Koreans who have jobs at factories in a northern economic zone. Pyongyang closed the border last week without an explanation.
Six people dead after Filipino troops clashed with Al-Qaeda militants who are holding three Red Cross workers hostage. No news on the status of the hostages. On Wall Street yesterday, the Dow and S&P both closed down a bit. The Dow starts trading today at 72.17. The S&P begins at 7:54. A flat to marginally positive opening is set in the futures market. The Pope arrives in Cameroon this morning on his first trip to Africa as pontiff. Sharia becomes law in parts of Islamic Pakistan. We want to hear from religious people. If you're a person of faith, what role do you think religion should play in shaping public policy? Who shapes your life the most, the government or your church or mosque? Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We are talking about religion and politics and the balance of it. We've been arguing about that in our political life, it seems to me, all the time I've been an adult.
Since caveman era, probably,
yes,
for the
indeed.
Human race.
Farai today is with me and sitting in for Adora Udoji. We are talking about a subject, religion and politics, that's very controversial, a life or death matter in South Asia. It provoked an interesting conversation on the pages of the New York Times. But before we get to that, let's think back to the campaign. Here in this clip, then-candidate Barack Obama was speaking on the campaign trail, outlining a policy and in insistence on something the U.S. government should do regarding Pakistan that sounded pretty darn plausible back in August of 2007.
There must be no safe havens for terrorists who threaten America. We cannot fail to act just because action is hard. As president, I would make hundreds of millions of dollars in U.S. military aid to Pakistan conditional, and I would make our conditions clear. Pakistan must make substantial progress in closing down the training camps, evicting foreign fighters, and preventing the Taliban from using Pakistan as a staging area for attacks in Afghanistan.
Now, it is the case that the Taliban and terrorists are not necessarily the same groups, but the idea of safe havens for the Taliban in Pakistan is a fact as of today. This week, an agreement between Taliban militants and Pakistan's government takes effect, making Sharia law, or Islamic religious law, the law of the land in an area called the Swat Valley that we've spoken about a lot on this program before. Kristen L. Rouse, former Army Supply Sergeant in Afghanistan, joins us here in the studio. She has served along the Afghan border, not very far from the Swat Valley. She has some provocative ideas about it, what it means to have Sharia law be implemented in this area. Also joining us is Christine Fair, Senior Political Scientist at the RAND Corporation. Christine, thanks for joining us from Northern Virginia.
Thank you very much.
Kristen, outline the argument that you sent in a letter to the New York Times that actually became an op-ed piece, a very prominently displayed op-ed piece. You think this is an unworkable agreement that works against any goals that the U.S. and NATO have in Afghanistan.
That's true, and thank you for having me, John and Farai. I really was, my main intent with that op-ed is to voice my outrage and the outrage that many Afghanistan veterans feel about negotiations with or concessions to the Taliban. The story that I told in my op-ed was a story from that I experienced when I was based at Bagram, Afghanistan, the big airfield where there's also a large hospital. And also experienced on the ground by one of my fellow soldiers, Jeanette Martinez, who actually was on the ground when this incident happened. There was a school in Assadabad, which is in Kunar province. It's the capital of Kunar province, and it's approximately 70 miles as the crow flies west of the Swat Valley. And there were children in a schoolyard, and you know, and many schools are simply schoolyards because there's no buildings for schools. And girls and boys were attending a primary school together, and two rockets hit them. The Taliban fired a direct hit on the children in the schoolyard, and another rocket hit nearby.
The assumption being that the integration of boys and girls in school violated Sharia law.
That is correct. And seven children were killed, and 34 were wounded. And, you know, and I saw some of the children who came in for advanced treatment at Bagram, and my friend Jeanette saw those children on the ground as the incident unfolded.
Christine Fair, as a matter of moral outrage in the story described by Kristen here, and also as a kind of concession to political reality in the region of the Swat Valley in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, is there a way of keeping the Taliban out of either the Swat Valley or the area around Bagram that Kristen talked about here?
Well, I think the first thing that we have to be a little bit more nuanced as to the Taliban. There's actually not one Taliban. In fact, there are probably a dozen or so different kinds of actors, if not more, who are all calling themselves the Taliban. What I think is more disturbing than the deal in Swat, and let's talk very briefly about what, quote, Sharia, unquote, is being applied in Swat. The actual spontaneous courts that the Talib fighters had imposed have largely disappeared. And what they've put in place is a system called the Qazi courts. This is a traditional Islamist court that's been around in Pakistan for some time. I want to remind people that Pakistan is an Islamist country. It has a federal Sharia court, although it doesn't do that much these days. And what the Qazi courts are, they're basically staffed with Islamist scholars. In other words, folks who are on the government payroll who are actually quite educated in the various five strands of Islamic thought in Pakistan. And it has an epaulette mechanism. Now, a couple of things are disturbing about this. One is that they extended this Qazi court system to areas well beyond those that were affected by the insurgency. It's like why they felt they need to negotiate a larger solution to those areas that were not affected by the militants is quite questionable. And I think that it actually is symptomatic, at least in SWAT, if not elsewhere, that the state simply has inadequate bureaucratic infrastructure to provide basic amenities to people, namely justice. And if you look at the way in which the Qazi court system has been laid out, what it really is appealing to a people's sense of due process and the failure to get justice in Pakistan's traditional legal system. Now, this is different from the numerous other deals, which are even more so egregious, that Pakistan has struck in Bajor and in North and South Waziristan, which those areas have a very direct set of implications for the Afghan Taliban, who are targeting our troops and those of NATO and our Afghan allies in Afghanistan.
Kristen, when you think about, I've had the opportunity to speak to many people who have been on the side, inside Afghanistan, not dealing with the Taliban in Pakistan. But there were concerns, at least initially by some citizens who were ruled by the Taliban, that they weren't able to envision anything but a lawless society without the Taliban. No matter how much they disliked the Taliban, at least there was a rule of law. Were you able to talk to anyone, even despite these bombings and what you saw with the children, who would argue, yeah, actually, the Taliban does enforce some form of law?
Well, that was the appeal of the Taliban in the early 90s, when they first came on the scene following the Soviet pullout, is that they did bring a rule of law. But, we can say a form of rule of law. And, these are heavily armed people. But in the end, as I see it, these are people who also, they exploit the dire poverty and the extreme, the high illiteracy rate. There's been a drought that's been on in Afghanistan for some years. They're very prone to natural disasters. It's just these people exploit that weakness and desperation in Afghan society in order to impose their own social controls.
But does the U.S. have any options? I mean, some things are easier to negotiate from an outsider's perspective. Some things aren't. Could the U.S. have done anything differently? I mean, you make an argument in your piece that this is not right, in your opinion, but could the U.S. have, on a practical level, done anything but said yes?
There are voices and there are people in Afghanistan who do not side with the Taliban.
In the Swat Valley in Pakistan, though, do you think that the U.S. had a choice in terms of saying, okay, we'll go along with this?
What I think is significantly missing is the voice of outrage. A voice of condemnation of the way that the Taliban exploits this poverty and illiteracy rate to impose their rule. And the fact that refugees are pouring out by the tens, even hundreds of thousands, I think shows the will of the people.
All right, Christine Fair. Kristen suggests here that any permission for the Taliban to be a part of the social structure is an invitation for violent militants to basically enforce brutal Sharia law in the ways that she's described in her piece. How practically can NATO and the U.S. separate the so-called responsible Taliban infrastructure from these other militants? Christine?
What I found so frustrating about the last exchange was there was this complete elision, this complete line drawn from Taliban and Afghanistan to the Taliban and SWAT, and it simply isn't the case. The people that are streaming out of SWAT are not only streaming out of SWAT because of the Taliban. Actually, the reason why they're streaming out of SWAT is because of the completely ineffective so-called counterinsurgency operations of the Pakistan Army, which have used fairly brutal air assets to decimate entire communities.
Well, the Taliban depends on what side of the border you're on, which Taliban you're dealing with. It's a balance here between the moral outrage described by Kristen Rouse and the complexity that you so articulately described there, Christine Fair. I think we're going to have to wait and see what the policy implications are that will develop. It's a very different world than during the campaign. My guests were Christine Fair, senior political scientist for the RAND Corporation, and Kristen Rouse, former Army Supply Sergeant in Afghanistan. Her op-ed is in the New York Times. Thanks to you both.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
And I'm Farai Chidea. We're going to talk about a story from Minneapolis, Minnesota. It's where at least 30,000 Somali immigrants have settled. Now officials at the local Department of Health are trying to figure out if children from these Somali families are being hit hard by rates of autism. Children are ill, sometimes hurting themselves. Parents are concerned. But the question is, are the cases random or part of a larger epidemic? Donald McNeil wrote a story for today's New York Times called An Outbreak of Autism or a Statistical Fluke. He's with us in the studio. And Donald, do we know if there are really more cases of autism or is this anecdotal?
I actually thought the headline on the story was unfortunate because I really wrote the story to talk about how what appears to be a surge in autism is terrifying the Somali community in Minneapolis. But to Somali parents who've noticed it and to pediatricians who've noticed it among their patients and to some people in the Minneapolis school system who treat kids with autism or run the special education classes, they see an enormous surge there, that 25% of the kids in the youngest special education classes for autism in Minneapolis are Somali, and only about 6% of the kids in the whole Minneapolis school system are Somali. The Minnesota Health Department is essentially saying, look, let us do the hard research we need to do in order to show that this is there, which means, one, trying to get an exact handle on how many Somalis there are in Minneapolis and how many what percentage of the kids in the school system are Somali, and then to diagnose the kids medically because they've been mostly diagnosed by special education people in the schools who've said this child has autism. But we're not talking about autism, you know, mild autism spectrum disorders like Asperger's. We're talking about serious, full-blown autism with, complete lack of communication, complete lack of eye contact, kids not speaking, kids flapping their hands. I mean, what we know is as full-blown autism.
And in general, based on your reporting, these symptoms manifest themselves after the families become citizens in this community in Minnesota, or what?
The apparent epidemic is mostly among kids who have been born in the United States. There are some kids who've been born in Somalia or in refugee camps in Kenya or Ethiopia or elsewhere who have autism. But by and large, the big surge in Somalis coming to Minnesota was an early surge in 1993 or so, and then there was a big surge in the year 2000. And it's among those kids, the kids 2 to 9 years old, that this is being noticed.
You mentioned that there's no word in Somali for autism, and people you describe how one person says, "Well, yeah, we just kind of call it crazy." I mean, is
that's different? Sorry, when they were saying that, they were saying we have words for schizophrenia and we have words for things like Down syndrome. We've seen that before, but our word isn't schizophrenia. It's more like it's more like your word for crazy. But they say there is no word for this. They call them the silent children or the American disease or the Minneapolis disease.
The
autismo.
American disease. That's interesting.
You can hear the frustration, though, in that linguistic attempt to describe
I mean, I appreciate you setting me straight on that. I think that, the frustration that you describe is very clear from the families. Do they think that if you call it the American disease, do they think that this country, either through air, water, toxins, culture, is responsible somehow for their children being dangerous to themselves, as the way many autistic children are?
People are confused and terrified since no one can answer their question, what is the cause of autism? They're left flailing for themselves, trying to figure out. Now, obviously, there are anti-vaccine activists who are coming into Minneapolis and saying, it's those vaccines you're giving your kids. You should stop vaccinating your kids. And some parents.
And the fact that they're Somalis supplies an argument. Well, obviously they weren't vaccinated over in Somalia, so here you're introducing an environmental factor. It obviously must be the case. It's an opportunity for them to make the argument.
There's a flip side to that argument, and a lot of families who were born in refugee camps have actually been vaccinated at least once and sometimes more than normal. That is, the mothers have been vaccinated more than is normal because they get passed through the system, and when they come to the United States, they have to have all their vaccinations. So, but there are kids who've got autism who you know had it manifested before while they were growing up in Somalia or in a refugee camp in Kenya, and they'd never had been vaccinated. And so it's there's really, I mean, in the confusion that existed about autism everywhere in the country, exists there. There are people who blame it on vitamin D deficiency. There are people who blame it on, you know, just some pollutant in America. There are hundreds of theories going around. Everybody's terrified because even the best medical authorities in the country can't answer the question, what gave your child this?
When you broaden this out to the debate, you talk about the debate over vaccines, people have all sorts of ideas about what causes autism and how to deal with it because, in fact, there is so much mystery left to this. How does this fit into the big picture of how autism is being explained and explored in America?
Right now, it's just a mystery. But if the Minnesota Health Authorities decide, yes, there is an unusual surge, then the next step, I'm sure, will be that they will look at other Somali communities in other cities in the country. I telephoned around to other Somali communities, but be it said, this is a completely unscientific poll. I'm just asking people and saying, do you have a problem? And people were aware of what was going on in Los Angeles, but they didn't necessarily think there was a surge of autism there in Seattle, where I called, or in Lewiston, Maine. So, but on the other hand, it hasn't been studied. What's likely to come out of this, if it does turn out that there are high rates of autism among Somalis in this country, I'm sure that genetic scientists will want to say there must be a genetic factor. Let's try to do genetic typing on the families and see if they can get families to cooperate and find if they can. Because when you have a disease concentrated in a population, one of the things you want to do is study the genetics of that population in order to find out if you can find the cause.
So in the end, what do we see ahead for these families? I've been able to visit some of the Somali-American communities, and there is – the only reason I mentioned Islam as the top, we've been talking about Islam today, but there is a little bit of a tight-knit quality to these communities. Just briefly, do you think that they are reaching out to the medical community and the medical community is reaching out to them?
In Minneapolis, yes, I think they are. And I think they are – one of the reasons that attracted Somalis to Minnesota was that the healthcare system is good, the welfare system is good. There is more support for them there than there is in a lot of other parts of the country. And I think the health system – the school system is trying to do something about it.
Well, Donald McNeil, thanks so much. Donald McNeil wrote a story for today's New York Times called An Outbreak of Autism or a Statistical Fluke. And now we go to Mark Garrison in for Femi Okay with the headlines.
Thank you, Farai. President Obama speaks with Irish Prime Minister Brian Cowan at the White House today. It will be followed by a gift ceremony. The president will also talk with two leaders from Northern Ireland. They'll discuss the need to maintain peace there despite some recent violence. Ireland's finance chief says the government is not planning to approach the European Central Bank or IMF for extra funding. He says Ireland's debt is low enough to raise funds on its own. Irish investigators are looking into an avian murder mystery in County Kerry. A rare white-tailed sea eagle has been found dead there. Experts say it's likely the bird was poisoned, possibly from toxic bait laid out by farmers. The bird was one of several involved in a project to reintroduce the birds into Ireland. Clearly Irish-born producer Jim Colgan has hijacked the headline story selection, and I think he's now inserting music into the program, so beware.
The white-tailed... What was the bird?
It was the white-tailed sea eagle. There was
the
a
white-tailed sea eagle.
Yeah, so they're worried it may have been killed accidentally. Okay. So it's investigation going on.
All the sea eagle coverage here on The Takeaway from Mark Garrison. Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adore Udoji.
Eat natural food, bake twice daily, fill your nostrils up with gravy. Don't drink tea and don't drink coffee. Cover your chin in Yorkshire toffee. Dancing in the disco, bumper to bumper. Wait a minute, where's me jumper? Where's me jumper?
Is it St. Patrick's Day today? Mm. What do they say? Is the Pope African? What does that mean? It could be, actually, sometime soon, the Pope being African. Pope's on his way to Africa. We'll have a story about that in a moment. But first, Mark Garrison, do you have any headlines that aren't in Ireland?
This is not the Jim Colgan hijack headlines. This is the what we do actually have out just a minute ago is we've got the housing starts numbers and the producer price index. I'm refreshing my tabs right now to try and get the full report. But I can give you basically the summary. Wholesale prices, they rose a little bit less than expected. That's despite a jump in energy costs. And then also new home construction went up a little bit. That was unexpected from what analysts were looking at. So that's what we have right there. If I can get the full report, actually, it's not coming up just yet. So we'll
come
back to
that. They've
been
record lows, so bouncing off the bottom isn't necessarily as significant.
Yeah, so that's what's going on. That's what we've been watching today. The markets can deal with that when they open up in about an hour. North Korea reopened its border to South Korean workers today. This after days of restricting access. Border shutdowns left hundreds of South Koreans stranded in North Korea or unable to get to their jobs. A small number of South Koreans work in North Korea in a special industrial zone. Those are the headlines.
Thank you, Mark. So the Pope we described this morning on this St. Paddy's Day is nowhere near Ireland this morning. Where is he? Well, he's in the air on the way to Cameroon. He's expected to land in about 2 hours.
He's the greatest human being on earth. So I feel very privileged as a Cameroonian that he has honored our country to come here.
Pope Benedict makes his first trip to Africa, and to talk about this trip and the continent's Catholicism, to put it in context, it is one of the fastest-growing places in the world for Catholicism. We spoke with BBC Rome correspondent David Willey, and even though this is Pope Benedict's first trip to Africa, which is home to my guest David Willey, accompanied the former pope many, if not all, of the times that the Pope John Paul went to Africa. It was a very popular destination for him. So David Willey is uniquely qualified to answer my first question. When we spoke, I asked him, what's it like when the pontiff steps on African soil and meets a very traditional group of African faithful who are also very culturally distinct from what we're used to seeing in the Vatican?
Well, I would say the arrival at countless airports in Africa, it was always a big deal. There was a lot of color, a lot of dust, a lot of dancing, a lot of music. And the Pope John Paul, the late Pope, seemed really to enjoy this. Sometimes people used to present him with funny hats, which he put on. He tapped his foot to the music of the drums, to the beat of the drums. He really enjoyed himself. One had the impression he liked the cultural differences between Europe and Africa. And this was one of the things he enjoyed most during his travels.
Now, it seemed that John Paul particularly embraced a sense of growth of Catholicism in Africa, but also a sense of traditional Catholicism. These were conservative Catholics growing at such a rapid rate. How does Pope Benedict view the traditionalism in Africa and also the sense that there are many social problems that need to be addressed by the Church?
Well, let's take the social problems first. I think that, as he said to people gathered in St. Peter's Square here in Rome last Sunday, that he's going to get first-hand information from his bishops in Africa about the poverty, about the violence, about the conflicts which pit one society against another in Africa, often with disastrous consequences, and also about the spread of disease. The Catholic Church, of course, has a big role in Africa, has had for many generations because of its missionary work. And the Pope will also be meeting members of his own missionary orders who do such good work both in education and in health. I think the Pope is very aware that the future of the Roman Catholic Church doesn't lie in old Europe. It lies in the New World and in particularly in the Southern Hemisphere. I think it's been calculated that two-thirds of the world's Catholics today live in the Southern Hemisphere, and this will be three-quarters by mid-century. So it's a vital look at the future, this trip to Africa.
David, when you look at the future, what do you see in terms of the priesthood? Because one thing that has happened in the U.S. is that there seem to be, and correct me if I'm wrong, not as many American-born priests, but a lot of international priests coming in to serve parishes in the U.S. Is Africa exporting priests who are running parishes in other parts of the world?
Yes, they are. For example, in the small village just outside Rome, where I have a house, we now have a priest from Congo. a black priest who is completely welcomed by the Italian parishioners. They regard it now as, I think it was a bit of a shock for them in the first place, but they now accept him completely. The position regarding vocations in Africa is that the Roman Catholic Church is very happy about the large number of vocations, priestly vocations in Africa. One of the biggest seminaries in the world, for example, is in Nigeria. I think the Pope will be encouraging Catholics in Africa to consider becoming priests. But the problem is that there are, it's a question of ratio. In the United States, the ratio of priests to lay Catholics is 1 to every 1,300. In Africa, it's almost 1 to 5,000. So they're spread around much more thinly than they are in the United States.
David, I'm wondering if the fact that the Catholic growth in Africa seems to be driving so many of the missions of the church in terms of focus on the Southern Hemisphere and some of the other things that you laid out, if it does the job of erasing some of the unsavory history of the missionary role in Africa during the colonial period and really transforms the identity of the church.
I think the church wants to show that it's looking to the future and not to the past. I think the Pope will be very interested, for example, during his visit to Angola, this huge and potentially very rich country bordering Nigeria, to see how the situation there is progressing after 27 years of civil war, which devastated the country. To what extent is the wealth of Africa being applied towards the people of Africa? I think this will be one of his concerns. The political leaders he'll be meeting don't really come up to scratch by our Western standards in terms of the fight against corruption. And one of the initiatives that the church tries to push in Africa is to fight corruption, not with great success, I must say. Both the heads of state he'll be seeing seem to be taking large amounts of oil revenue and putting it into their own pockets rather than for the benefit of the people.
But the hope this morning as the Pope lands in Africa, my guest was longtime BBC Rome correspondent David Willey, who helped us understand the importance of Africa to the growing Catholic Church, growing in Africa in any case. That interview we did earlier this morning. The Pope is scheduled to land in about an hour and a half's time. His first stop is Cameroon, then he'll be going to Angola. What is the role of religion in shaping public policy in your life? We're calling out to people who describe themselves as religious or faithful. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Good morning and happy St. Patrick's Day to all of you. Now, we've been, you know, repeating this fact for quite a while in the midst of this economic transformation. There are no investment banks left in the United States. All had to recharter themselves as regular banks, or they just went out of business like Lehman Brothers or Bear Stearns. Banks are changing. The rules of banking are being rewritten moment to moment, whether it's bonuses or interest rates that can be charged. But for 28 million people in this country, that's like an old story. They've been living without bank accounts entirely for a long, long time. They haven't had to deal with overdraft fees, bouncing checks, not a part of their reality. Frank Garcia joins us. He's the chairman of the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce in the Bronx, also the owner of Millennium Recycled Toner, a small business in the Bronx. Frank, are you bankless or do you actually bank in the Bronx?
I do have a bank account with CheckSpring, a new bank. Personally, I don't have a bank account. I just don't believe in it personally for my own personal, only for the business because I have to.
Now, people in the Bronx buy safes as an alternative to banks because, number one, they're underserved, and number two, they don't trust the banks. So explain to me the trust issue, and it certainly predates the problems with AIG.
I think the reason why a lot of Hispanic and minority community and small businesses don't trust the banks because the banks have been very insensitive to the Bronx when it comes to loans, and there have been research that a lot of different research companies are doing, that the banks are not being sensitive to the community. So the community is like, why should I bank with this bank? I might lose my hard-earned money. So a lot of the community is very nervous about putting money into these banks.
And do you think that's replicated in communities around the United States or unique to the Bronx? And we know there is a lot unique to the Bronx.
Even though it is unique to the Bronx, speaking to some of my colleagues that are heads of chambers in Chicago, California, Texas, the Latino community have our own struggles right now. And I think our biggest struggle is understanding Wall Street and understanding what's going on. Our community just doesn't understand it and don't want to understand it. So they'd rather just go and buy a safe than going and banking. And the frustration of going to a bank and asking for a loan and them saying no, it's just really, really difficult for them right now.
And it's embarrassing. And without a credit history, it's very, very difficult to do. Can you imagine a bank bodega in the Bronx that would actually be culturally appropriate and provide the services that people need and address this issue of trust? And if so, what would it look like?
Right now, the Bodega Association, and this is something that the NSA, the Supermarket Association, the Bodega Association are looking to do that because they understand our community needs to bank and they need to be sensitive. I think that having people like the Bodega Association or the different bodegas is a great idea because we trust the bodega to go get our milk. Why not also bank? I think we've
get
proven
your money,
that
get the, put your money where your milk is. That's a great slogan. That's a great slogan, Frank.
I think it is. I think it's something that we need to look into it as the head of the chamber. My grandfather was the founder of the first Puerto Rican bodega in New York City, believe it or not, Nazario Garcia.
Well, congratulations. You know, we're going to leave it there, but that's a great idea. It's a great takeaway. Put your money where your milk is. Why not rewrite the banking rules from the street level? Frank Garcia is chairman of the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce in the Bronx. His small business is Millennium Recycled Toner. He doesn't have a bank account, just like 28 million other people in this country who live without banks. Thanks, Frank.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
My Big Fat Greek Wedding, you remember that movie. Well, it's not actually about a big fat Persian wedding, but it is about one wedding that tells a very complicated historical story about relations between the United States and Iran. We'll find out about it right after headlines from Mark Garrison in for Femi Oke.
Thank you, John. It's 12 minutes before the hour. President Obama is pledging to block insurance giant AIG from handing out some $165 million in executive bonuses. The Treasury may place restrictions on the latest installment of bailout money scheduled to go to AIG. All told, the government has given it some $170 billion in bailout money. Meanwhile, New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo said yesterday he plans to issue subpoenas to AIG for information on the bonuses. The insurer said it would respond to the AG's request. From insurance to trade, where Mexico says it will increase the tariffs on dozens of American products. It's in retaliation for the U.S. decision last week to cancel a program that allowed Mexican truck drivers to transport goods within the United States. Mexico says the move violates NAFTA. It didn't specify which products would be slapped with the tariffs. The White House says it will work to create another program that works for both governments. There's new political upheaval in the African nation of Madagascar. The president is holed up in his palace while opposition soldiers take control of another presidential building. The opposition accuses the president of misusing public money and undermining democracy. The president says the opposition is seizing power unconstitutionally. The power clash has lasted some 2 months. At least 100 people are dead in violence connected to it. Pope Benedict says condom distribution is not the answer to the global AIDS crisis. He says giving out condoms actually can increase the problem. The comments are the Pope's first explicit views on condom use. He spoke aboard the papal plane en route to Africa. He'll be there for a week, stopping first in Cameroon to meet with regional Catholic leaders.
If you're on a long flight and some strangely dressed guy started talking about condoms, would you talk with him?
If you're in first class and you can stretch your legs out,
Okay, just wondered.
If you want to hear.
Thank you, Mark. Continuing on the Pope Benedict story, he's set to arrive in Cameroon this morning on his first trip to Africa as pontiff. Sharia becomes law in parts of Pakistan. Our discussion this morning relates to religion and politics, the balance. We're calling on you. If you think of yourself as religious or as one of the faithful, tell us your story. What should be the role of religion in politics and public policy? How should it shape public policy? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
And I would add that I had a really interesting conversation with the head of the GOP, Michael Steele. He is a former monk and does not believe in what I think many people think of as separation of church and state. So if you don't believe in separation of church and state, call us too, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Moving on, in religious terms, there are times when you think about religion impacting your life. One of those is marriage. Imagine you're getting married and your American parents and your partner's Iranian parents are meeting for the very first time.
Nice to bring everybody
Here's
together.
Here's to finally having you
so
guys
So nice
meet.
To meet you both.
Nice to meet you. Thank you very much. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, now that you know you're so close, we can do this.
Oh, that sounds lovely.
Yeah,
sounds lovely.
Everything
very
was
friendly,
just going deliciously until this moment.
So how do you feel about the policies of this government in Middle East?
Ouch.
I agree.
You don't?
I agree with the government's policy.
With the government's policy.
Yeah, I think President Bush was very wise in doing some of the things that he's done with Iraq and Afghanistan. I think Iran presents a whole different situation. It's not clear.
You should try some of this fish. It came from San Francisco market.
You know, Iranians have suffered tremendously because of the policies of the American government.
Try the fish, please.
Oh, look, we're laughing hysterically, and we haven't introduced our guest yet. We are talking about a movie, Arusi, Persian Wedding, which premieres tonight on PBS's great series Independent Lens. And it focuses on the wedding of Alex Tehrani, Iranian-American, who travels to Iran to marry his all-American wife, Heather. Now, the trip was filmed by his sister, Marjan, a director and producer, and both of them, Marjan and Alex, are here in the studio with us. Hi, guys. How you doing?
Hey. Good. Thank you.
So how does it feel, and I guess I'll start with you, Alex, to just be naked before the camera, not literally, but emotionally?
You know, strangely enough, I never thought about this film as being about us. It always felt to me like we were sort of the vehicle to tell a bigger story. And, I mean, we were strapped with mics, and that was definitely, I guess, an intrusive element to our trip. But it just never felt... I never felt any of the glow here. It always felt like it was about the relationship between Iran and the U.S.
27 years was the amount of time that you had been away?
Yeah, since before the revolution. As a kid in the 70s, we'd been a couple times, but after the revolution, I wasn't able to go unless I was willing to do military service. So once my father hit a certain age and I was the only son, I became exempt from that and finally could make that trip.
Military service in Iran in the 1980s meant being in suicide waves in the Iran-Iraq war. So military service was a very dicey question.
I don't even know all the levels of what it would have encompassed, but it just never sounded appealing.
I just am thinking, and Marjan, I'm going to talk to you in a second, but Alex, I'm just thinking of this moment where you're with your wife and you're about to go out into the marketplace, into the streets, and she has certain ideas about how to wear her head covering, a bright head covering. She wants to hold hands with you. And what was it like to realize that you had to set some limits on how both of you experienced this trip back? Did you feel like you had to be an enforcer at certain points?
I think a lot of the way I reacted to the way she was taking on that experience was coming from my own. I had a lot of my own insecurities and concerns. And I was so determined to feel like I was finally back at home in some way. And in fact, I felt really out of place, and that made me feel uncomfortable, and I wanted her to help me fit in. There was a lot of levels to where that was. And I think she approached that trip much more as something exciting and new and fun, whereas for me, I was really determined to have this deep experience of kind of heading home. And I ended up kind of feeling like the American kid, and she was more like, let's do this, let's do that, let's meet everybody, let's
That's
walk
great.
The streets.
You know, I've spent a lot of time in Tehran, not recently, but, you know, and post-revolution. And Tehran is a city where people speak their mind and speak at length, and it's kind of a miracle city for a filmmaker because you get it all on tape. What was it like filming there?
I mean, absolutely. It was amazing to just see you. The women especially are so, they wanted to approach us and talk to us and share their opinions. And people ask me what was the biggest surprise. And I think just how candid all the Iranians were and how much they wanted to engage with us, knowing that we came from the States.
Marjan, what did it feel like for you? You are not the star of this movie, but you are the maestro or the maestra who's, you know, putting everyone in place to show this meeting of cultures. What was your goal with this movie? What do you want people to take away from it?
I really want people to see, I mean, I think the combination of an intimate journey with the telling of the history allows people to understand, have a different perspective on Iran. We see so many things about Iran that are so negative in our media. So that was my goal.
Speaking of which, I mean, I think a lot of people have one very specific context about Iran.
Good evening. It is now day 75 of captivity for the hostages in Tehran.
We're not going to take it anymore!
The nation burned like a bonfire over the hostage situation.
Most of the Iranians ran, but a few tried to defend themselves.
These protesters decided to burn their own version of the Iranian flag.
When you think about that feedback loop of how America processed Iran, do you think we've progressed?
I am sad to say that I don't think there has been too much progression about
really
how we think. I think people, you know, still think that Iran's been sealed off since the hostage crisis. And I think that's really evident in how a lot of Americans perceive what's going on in Iran. It's always about Ahmadinejad and what's going on with the government, but very little about what people are, who the people are.
Well, you know, there's so much to talk about, and I wish we could spend more time on the issues of family, the issues of what it's like for in a post 9/11, post Iraq and Afghanistan war world. There were some definite moments of intercultural dialogue, but right now, what I will say is that the film is going to come on tonight, and you also can see clips on your website. What's your website?
My website is PBS/independent lens at Arusi Persian Wedding.
All right, great. Marjan, Alex Tehrani, thanks you so much.
So religion and politics, as the Pope is set to visit Africa this morning, we want to hear specifically from religious people. If you're a person of faith, what role do you think religion should play in shaping public policy? We've heard from the perspective of some Iranians getting married. We've also heard from the perspective of people in Pakistan and from a Catholic. Who shapes your life the most, the government or your church or mosque? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Here's your takeaway for this hour.
There's actually not one Taliban. In fact, there are probably a dozen or so different kinds of actors, if not more, who are all calling themselves the Taliban.
Complexity in the Swat Valley of Pakistan. That's Christine Fair, senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Where bank failure is not news, just normal.
There's not a bank in a half a mile radius. And a half a mile radius in this area of the Bronx equals about 70,000 people.
When banks don't compete for your business, who loses? Banks give up on consumers. Consumers find alternatives. In some neighborhoods, you might say finding a bank is harder than robbing one. This is a stick up. We found you. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Huckenberry. It's Tuesday, March 17th on this St. Paddy's Day.
Yes, I just learned how to pronounce T-A-O-I-S-E-A-C-H, which is not Tao is each, it's T-Shock. We'll get to that in a moment. I'm Farai Chidea, in for Adora. We'll discuss the furor over the AIG bonuses, future of credit cards, and limits on immigration. All ahead, but first these headlines.
A T-Shock mystery coming up. Some new economic indicators just out this hour. A number of new homes that began construction in February compared to January actually rose more than 22%. Analysts were expecting a drop. Wholesale prices for last month edged up 0.1%. Futures market is bouncing off the bottom. It looks like a slightly positive open this morning on Wall Street in less than 30 minutes. AIG paying out $165 million in bonuses. And now there are more people angry, and President Obama is one of them.
This is a corporation that finds itself in financial distress due to recklessness and greed. Under these circumstances, it's hard to understand how derivative traders at AIG warranted any bonuses.
The news on this broke last week, but the anger has been building. The White House is now placing restrictions, or wants to place restrictions, on a $30 billion installment of bailout money scheduled to go to AIG.
AIG is going to be the topic of conversation in Congress as well. It is holding two hearings focusing on the insurance industry. A Senate panel is going to look into whether insurance companies should be regulated by the state or the federal government, while a House committee examines systemic risk in the financial industry with an eye toward allowing companies to grow that grow too big to fail. And it is St. Patrick's Day, and President Obama is marking the day with a meeting with Ireland's Taoiseach, or Irish Prime Minister. Just Wikipedia it. The pronouncers are very strange on Wikipedia. But anyway, he's
so
going to...
So the Taoiseach's in town. Is
yes,
that right? I see.
He yeah, is indeed. Well, you're going to have your fake Irish revoked for using your accent.
It's
but
been
anyway,
revoked for years.
He's going to meet with Brian Cowan and then with leaders from Northern Ireland. They're going to talk about peace. Also overseas, Pope Benedict visits Cameroon.
And that's his first Africa trip, and that's a very significant issue in Catholicism. The Pope nowhere near Ireland today. Six people dead after Filipino troops clashed with Al-Qaeda militants or are holding three Red Cross workers hostage. No news on the status of those hostages. They've been captive for more than 2 months. Wall Street and the S&P begin trading at 752. That's the S&P anyway, as we said, a slightly flat to positive opening. So we're talking about the banks. If there's no bank in your neighborhood, have you found an alternative? If there is a bank in your neighborhood, what do you like about your bank? If you're not the type to keep a bank account in under any circumstances, where do you keep your money? Tell us your banking story at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I'm here with Farai Chidea and Adora Udoji. Hello. Hello. So remember, AIG used to be this obscure insurance company that you didn't even know what it meant, the American International Group. That was if you were like a smarty pants, you knew that. Well, the obscure AIG acronym has become a synonym for greed and corruption in the financial meltdown, almost a four-letter word, although it's a three-letter acronym. To express your outrage over AIG and its bonuses, which were announced last week, you can either be polite, like our president.
In the last 6 months, AIG has received substantial sums from the U.S. Treasury. And I've asked Secretary Geithner to use that leverage and pursue every single legal avenue to block these bonuses and make the American taxpayers whole.
Or your outrage could be a little more passionate, as Senator Charles Grassley from Iowa mentioned yesterday.
The first thing that would make me feel a little bit better towards them, if they'd follow the Japanese example and come before the American people and take that deep bow and say, I'm sorry, and then either do one of two things, resign or go commit suicide.
On guard. I'll let you try my Wu-Tang style.
Does Senator Grassley have a Wu-Tang style there? What was he talking about? Well, his spokespeople say he wasn't actually hoping that AIG executives commit suicide, but it is an indication of the temperature of the rhetoric about AIG and its bonuses. Joining us now is Jackie Collins, New York Times National Desk reporter. Jackie, thanks for joining us from Washington. First of all, these were contracts. The administration had to know about this, but there's certainly a sense that they haven't done a very good job of staying out in front of the national outrage over AIG and the bailout. What's going on?
Well, it's unclear at this point. I mean, the news about these latest payments came out late last week and over the weekend, but too late to really do anything. They were right on the deadline, March 15th, for the checks to go out. And, you know, on the one hand, you could say that, you know, this was a deal, this bailout of AIG that goes back to last September and before the administration was even elected, let alone inaugurated, and that they've been, you know, tending to economic problems that for everyone is like drinking water out of a fire hose, and it just slipped through the cracks. But, you know, that shouldn't be, I suppose, for a White House and an administration that has shown such political talent in the past. You know, this is, we already had bailout fatigue in this country building. This, anybody could tell, was just going to be, you know, like throwing kerosene on a fire.
Now, you know, Timothy Geithner, Secretary of the Treasury, worked at the New York Fed. He's, you know, comfortable with the terminology for compensation and, you know, what the rest of us call wages. But is it possible that there's some sort of linguistic problem, that people don't really understand the context in which investment bankers receive a bonus and it's, you know, part of their compensation? And maybe, you know, if we just were more familiar with the way they do things on Wall Street, we wouldn't be so outraged?
Well, perhaps, but it's just that none of this has been very transparent, and at a point where, you know, the government owns 80% of AIG at this point, you'd like to think that, you know, we could have a little more information. It was only over the weekend that AIG finally identified the major, what we call the counterparties. Those are the major companies, including Goldman Sachs and the like, who had received billions in sharing in the bailout of AIG, which is the very reason AIG was bailed out in the first place, which is it essentially insures, you know, not just individuals but major companies against losses. So last year, as those losses at various companies mounted and AIG was on the hook for them, to have let AIG go down would have been like, you know, a rock pulling down everything else into the abyss with it.
Well, we've heard the too big to fail argument, but yet to deal with these bonuses, someone on our air yesterday said that conceivably the government owns so much of AIG that it could just basically declare AIG a non-existent company, reformulate it as, you know, GIA, and all of a sudden the contracts are null and void. Larry Summers is talking about rule of law. We can't touch the contracts. Any chance that something like that, something radical like that, could be done?
Well, you know, I couldn't. There is a chance, but every time these options have been looked at and they've, for one reason or another, been set aside. Let me give you one example. To just say, well, you know, we're not going to honor those contracts. And the thinking is, what I'm told, is that you'd have a major civil class action lawsuit on your hands that in the end might take the government, cost the government, taxpayers, more money. And, you know, we have to remember, take the eye off the ball. I mean, I think President Obama said in his inaugural address, we can't, or his State of the Union speech, or what amounted to one, that we can't govern in anger. There's a lot the government's doing right now, and government officials, that to get all, you know, they're trying to put together a financial rescue plan to get credit moving in this country. And so for every minute that these people are spending trying to address the anger on AIG, you know, they're not doing these other things. So, and as for the class action suit, you know, if you're paying all that money, who knows? But, you know, you reach a point where it might be a gamble worth taking. And that's the thinking now, especially in light of this furor.
Well, anger gets too hot and it begins to affect policy, that's for sure. And we certainly saw that in the words of Senator Grassley yesterday. Jackie Collins, the New York Times national correspondent, talking about AIG. Can we touch those bonuses or are the contracts sacrosanct? That's the contradiction in Washington. Fry?
Thanks, John. Well, turning to another economic issue, and it seems like all we have are economic issues. This year alone, tens of millions of people across the world are going to lose their jobs, people making dollars a day and millions of dollars a year. That's making governments very nervous. So Australia this week announced it was limiting immigration quotas by 14%. And here in the U.S., any company that takes government bailout money has strict new rules about hiring international workers. It sounds like common sense to protect citizens' jobs, but Vivek Wadhwa, Duke professor and a researcher at Harvard Law School's Labor and Work-Life program, says, let's take another look at it. So Vivek's with us. How are you? And what do you think of these new rules and restrictions in different countries?
Good morning, Farai. You know, what tends to happen is that when you start being protectionist, it becomes a snowball. And one thing leads to another, and ultimately you end up hurting your economy. And that's what I fear is going to happen over here with the legislation that was passed limiting the rights of banks to hire MBAs, foreign students, basically.
So you're talking specifically about the U.S. right now, and there are many different, you know, there have been many different critiques of the changes in U.S. rules and regulations in light of what some might call the collapse of the economy as we know it. How can you have a dialogue between people who look at the impact of immigration on the labor force and people who are just scared about their jobs? How can you have even set the table for it?
Yeah, right. It's very, very difficult. And I've been getting barrages of nasty emails from people because I've been saying that we need to keep our doors open. We need to keep encouraging skilled immigrants to come here and to start companies. The fact is that if you look at the data, over the last 10 or 15 years, the vast majority of startups basically have been founded by immigrants. 52% of Silicon Valley startups were founded by immigrants. Immigrants have contributed significantly to our global patents. They basically have created more jobs than they've taken away. So now what we're doing is that now things are tough. Yes, I understand many people are being laid off and it's tough. But if you now start telling your foreign nationals that we don't want you anymore, and you start telling companies to fire foreigners before they fire Americans, it's a slippery slope.
Now, let's compare this, what's going on in the U.S., to Australia. Specifically, the immigration minister said that they were going to restrain the number of people maximum coming into the country as workers. And he said, we're going to cut it from 133,500 to 115,000. So that's about a 14% cut. Now, without going too deep into the Australian economy, what's happening there and how does it compare the sort of limits on immigration with what we're seeing in the U.S.?
You have to realize that Australia has a population of about 14 million people. So we're talking about huge numbers relatively. We allow 120,000 skilled immigrants a year in the three top visa categories. So we're talking about the whole of Australia, which has a population of 5% of what we have, admitting as many as we do. And they are, they've learned from us. They and other countries have learned that one of America's greatest advantages has been immigration. And they're learning from us, and we're forgetting what made us what we are.
Well, thanks so much. That was Vivek Wadhwa, Duke professor and researcher at Harvard Law School's Labor and Work-Life program. A lot to think about. The future of America doesn't include the future of immigrants who work here.
Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
And I'm Farai Chidea. This morning we are talking about banks. Okay, what do you like about your bank? I like the fact that they have cookies, even though they're really unhealthy for me, John. If you're not keeping a bank account, what don't you like about banks? Intimidating? Taking your money for all those crazy fees? Tell us your stories about banking, what you use, what you don't. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. John?
Light, camera, action!
Lights, camera, action. We got an outtake for you this morning. That's a perspective that you're not going to hear anywhere else in this segment. Think about the economy. Farai was talking about banks a moment ago. What drove the stock market bubble of the 1990s? Irrational exuberance, if you ask Alan Greenspan. What drove the prosperity of the previous decade? Really, the housing bubble. And what drove consumer spending through that entire time? An increase in proliferation of consumer debt in the form of credit cards. Joining us now is Christian Weller, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and associate professor of public policy at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Christian Weller, first of all, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, banks are having trouble valuing assets such as credit default swaps and mortgage-backed securities, which means people aren't paying their mortgages. Are banks having trouble valuing the so-called assets that are represented by credit card accounts in their portfolios? And how big of a number are we talking about here?
Well, so far, the credit card market still is somewhat more liquid than other markets and still working, but there's certainly trouble brewing. It's not quite as large as the mortgage market. In fact, the credit card market generally is only about a third of the mortgage market, but the chance of losses in the credit card market is substantially higher. Typically, the default rates on credit cards tends to be somewhere between 3 and 4 times higher than for mortgages, even at the high end of mortgages. So you quickly, on the losses, you quickly catch up to mortgages with credit cards. Right now, for the end of 2008, credit card issuers had to basically write off 6.3% of all the loans, credit card debt that they had issued. And just to say this very clearly, this is a historic high. We have data going back to 1980. There's one little quarter in those years where one bank wrote a lot of money off. That's a little higher. But in the historical trend, this is the highest, 6.3%. And the rating firms, the consultings, expect that we're going to go to 8 to 9% by the end of 2009. And that certainly would be a record setter, and it's certainly troublesome in the current environment where the banks are already piling on losses in every corner of the business.
Beyond troublesome, though, does a rapid acceleration of the default rate on the credit card market threaten banks themselves? And what about consumers? Is this a wave of a shrinkage of credit that will actually cause a cash flow crisis in individual households?
Well, it starts, obviously, with a consumer. I mean, this reflects a lot of pain at the consumer end, and it will come back to the consumer, as you said. Ultimately, the credit card companies, and the credit card companies are already reacting to this. They basically, it's like American Express pays consumers to get away, give them $300 if they pay off their balance within a certain amount of time. A number of other banks have already been reducing the credit card limits, and then a number of other banks have been raising fees, monthly fees, annual fees on their customers, and have been increasing the interest rates. The important thing is where the credit card companies are doing those things, raising the fees, raising interest rates, is typically the customers who need it the most, the customers who are so-called revolvers, people who don't pay off their credit card balance month to month, who actually need the credit card as a loan instrument, not just a convenience.
You mentioned the shrinking amount of credit. Companies just can at any point go ahead and reduce credit. And there was a story that got some traction about a guy who basically, in order to save money, he didn't lose his job or anything. God knows that's not a sin either. Started shopping at less expensive stores, and they downed his limit because they thought that he was in distress. How are people making these decisions who run credit card companies? Are they using good metrics to decide who gets credit and who doesn't?
It's often very sophisticated and is up to the individual banks. It's that the banks ultimately have their own pricing models, what they identify as consumer behavior that trigger certain activities is certainly up to the individual banks, and it's not something that the banks really disclose. Typically what happens is the banks will quickly, in the current environment, they will reduce the limits, but in the past they typically have raised interest rates or fees if they feel there is a customer who behaves in a way that's irresponsible.
Now, your apocalyptic argument that this entire credit market is actually threatened is not shared by a lot of economists. And I wonder if you see the banks adjusting cash flow to basically look better on their balance sheets, or are they trying to get out ahead of a tsunami that they see coming?
Well, I mean, they're seeing something very quickly, and that is, I mean, the credit card market works similar to the housing market in a mortgage market, that basically you give the customer the credit, and then you turn around and you bundle a bunch of credit debt and you sell it off as a bundle. It's typically sold to other banks. That makes it somewhat different from the mortgage asset-backed securities market. But there is an escape clause, an exit clause for the investor here, and that is if you basically don't make the profit that you were promised on it, you can give the thing back to the banks.
Oh,
or
wow.
You could ask for more cash, so like reserves, and that's ultimately what we're bumping up against.
Well, that's not just a toxic asset. That's sort of the takeaway here. It's a toxic boomerang that could ripple potentially throughout the entire banking sector. My guest, Christian Weller, is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, also an associate professor of public policy at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. There's your outtake. Mark Garrison has some headlines.
Thank you, John. Coming up on 29 minutes after the hour, fierce fighting continues between local soldiers and Qaeda-linked militants in the Philippines today. Gunmen are holding three Red Cross workers hostage. The deadly fighting began yesterday after the gunmen tried to break out of a government barricade that boxed in militants and the hostages. The fighters are with a group called Abu Sayyaf. The Red Cross workers were kidnapped in January. So far, the Philippine military has stopped short of trying to fully rescue the hostages for fear they would be harmed. UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown is warning Iran needs to make a choice on its nuclear program. Earlier this morning, he said Iran needs to stop defying the international community and abandon a program to enrich uranium for weapons. Iran says its program is for civil nuclear power, not nuclear weapons. The U.S. military says it shot down an Iranian drone that entered Iraqi airspace last month. The U.S. accuses Iran of deliberately sending it. The drone crossed over into Iraqi skies for about an hour. Iran has made no comment. That's the news. John and Farai.
Thank you, Mark.
You.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Farai Chidea, and we're going to follow up on a serious story that we talked about yesterday. There's a new report funded by the Center for Disease Control saying that 3% of people in Washington, D.C. have HIV. Now, that's three times the level considered an epidemic. Activists and public health officials have tried promoting safer sex and other interventions to stop AIDS for two decades. So why aren't we closer to ending the epidemic? We've got Daniel Halperin of Harvard University School of Public Health with us today. Daniel, you've been tracking HIV prevention. What is going on here?
Look, the HIV epidemic in Washington, D.C. is definitely a bad one. And it's much, much worse than almost anywhere else in the United States. Of course, it's similarly bad in some other large cities. But this, it's not necessarily worse than it's been. And without going into all the complicated statistical reasons.
Yeah, we did hear that it could be better tracking. But do you think that in general, even if there's a large margin of error that we're talking about, that people are either ignoring or not getting public health messages, or simply, you know, we discussed here in the office the other day, is it just so hard for us to change our behavior? How do you factor in all those things?
I think it's a combination of things. First of all, just to get it out of the way, yes, it's better tracking, but also when I've been looking at the data from D.C., a couple of things have struck me. Now, most of my work over the last 15 years has been in Africa and other developing regions. I do follow the U.S. epidemic to some extent, but I'm not really an expert on the U.S. epidemic. But I know comparisons are being made to Africa, to the epidemics in Africa. And it's really very different in many ways than the epidemics in Africa. There are some similarities that are actually quite interesting. But one big difference is that, according to the report, which was just released yesterday, it says that over 70% of people with HIV in Washington, D.C. are over the age of 40. So it is not at all a youth epidemic. And what I read into that is that a lot of the reason that the prevalence of HIV may have gone up somewhat in D.C. is actually, believe it or not, a representation of success. What do I mean by that? What I mean is that a lot of people have been placed on antiretroviral medications now. So what you get essentially is a situation where you have a lot of people that years ago would be dead now. After about 10 years, most people are dead if they had HIV infection at least 10 years ago. These people are still alive. So that's a good thing. People who would have been dead otherwise are alive because of these medications. But what that will tend to do statistically over time is raise the level of prevalence, because you have more and more people who have the virus, who are still living, and then, of course, new people getting infected. And when you add that all up, the epidemic seems to be going up. So I just thought I'd mention that. But to get to your question, it's a combination of reasons. One problem that we've had in the United States, and we've seen this in San Francisco, where I'm originally from, and we've seen this in many parts of the United States, Europe, and Australia, is that as antiretroviral medications have become available over the last 13 years, which is a wonderful life-saving boon, it's had this unintended negative consequence in terms of behavior change, which is that until antiretrovirals came along, AIDS was literally a death sentence. If you got HIV, people understood that you basically would end up dying, and there was a terrible amount of fear, by many people at least, of getting the disease. And so we did have a lot of behavior change. In San Francisco, in the early 80s, when HIV was first, you know, realized that this virus was living among the population, there was really a huge amount of behavior change that happened rather quickly. And it wasn't mainly even due to official programs. It was due to people in the community just saying, oh, my God, we really have to change or we're going to be the next victim. But unfortunately, we've seen to some degree an unraveling of that behavior change since the availability of antiretrovirals has come. It's an inadvertent, unintended consequence where AIDS isn't really necessarily a death sentence anymore. You can potentially live many years if you take the medications. And so some young gay men in the United States, for example, they don't know people who died of AIDS. It's a sort of new generation. It's unlike the people 25 years ago where everybody knew somebody who had been devastated by this disease. Young people, they don't have that experience, so that there's less fear because of that. And also there's a sense of, well, if I get it, I can take the medications. So this is not the only reason, but it's part of the reason that we're finding it difficult to either change behavior or even we're seeing worsening of behavior due to this kind of a situation. Now, in a place like D.C., you compound that with a very terrible inner-city poverty that's related to drug addiction and lots of other issues. I mean, so there's all a combination of factors going on there.
Daniel, great to get your perspective on this, and thanks. That was Daniel Halperin of Harvard University School of Public Health talking about why there might even be reversals in behavior around HIV prevention. Interesting.
Along the story we did yesterday, the difficulty of changing behavior as a public health matter when you have to really follow people and make sure their behaviors change over a long period of time.
Absolutely.
So banks produce all kinds of passions in you. What do you actually like about your bank? And if you're not the type to keep a bank account, where do you keep your money?
What I don't like about banks is that every time there's a problem, it always seems to be in their favor. Anything that happens is always, you always get charged a fee and you have to call them to remove it. There's nothing that happens in the favor of the consumer.
So just to pull out your bank statement, take a look at those fees and give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
My name is Diane Taylor from Royal Oak, Michigan, and I want to mention credit unions. I have perhaps an irrational emotional attachment to mine. I've been a member of for 30-plus years. SBA credit unions.
So, alternatives to banks. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're going to be looking at people finding alternatives to banks and 28 million Americans underserved by banks in just a moment. But first, Mark Garrison has the headlines on this St. Paddy's Day.
Thank you, sir. Coming up on 21 minutes before the hour. And today is the final newspaper delivery for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. We talked about this yesterday on The Takeaway. Got a lot of responses. The nearly 150-year-old news outlet is going online only and with a severely reduced staff. It's the largest American paper to kill its print edition for a web-only presence. Local residents who still want ink on their fingers still have the site Seattle Times. North Korean Premier Kim Jong-il is in Beijing today talking about regional tensions. He's not to be confused with eccentric top leader Kim Jong-il. China is expected to pressure North Korea to ease regional tensions and return to six-party talks aimed at ending the North's nuclear weapons program. Hamas says progress has been made in talks for a prisoner swap with Israel, but that differs from Israel's latest take on things. It says the Palestinian group has hardened its position and backed away from earlier understandings. The deal could involve the release of hundreds of Palestinian prisoners for an Israeli soldier held captive for years. The International Space Station won't have to be moved after all. Engineers now say floating space debris headed towards the station does not appear to pose a threat. That's good news as the Space Shuttle Discovery is due to link up with the station later today. The shuttle is delivering the last set of solar wings to fully power the station. And tonight, college basketball's March Madness tournament starts, sort of. This is a so-called play-in game. Teams number 64 and 65 play for the right to face top seed at Louisville this year.
Why do they do that?
So get somebody extra. I mean, the long answer is they had, like, one extra conference, and certain conferences get a free pass, and so they didn't want to, like, you know, I guess they'd have to let 16 more people in, so they just let one and have a playing game.
So
like
it's
that.
Kind of the walk-on. It's sort of the Cinderella.
Yeah.
So maybe miracles might happen if you win.
It hasn't yet.
No, and it would be a miracle if they beat Louisville, right?
It's possible. It's possible. But Alamo State has some fans. They have a player named Chief Kicking Stallion Sims Jr., and he's getting a lot of attention on the internet as a unique name that he has.
Does that fit on his jersey?
It must be a large
Kicking
jersey.
Stallion
he's a big
Sims.
Guy, though, 7'1".
7'1"? Yeah, sure, you could do it. He's Navajo, right? Part Navajo?
Yes.
Thanks, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. All right, just pay them their damn bonuses, okay? The AIGA wants $165 million in bonuses that they claim they're contractually obligated to receive. Pay them. An argument for just paying the bonuses and moving on with it is laid out in today's New York Times by Andrew Ross Sorkin, his chief mergers and acquisitions correspondent for the New York Times. Andrew, we just have a few minutes. Let me just summarize the argument if I can. On the one hand, it's about if we violate these contracts, it will basically cast doubt on all of the contracts throughout the economy and possibly, make our slope even slipperier.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or it's about keeping individuals who the talents of whom are really needed for AIG to get through this mess to begin with. Is that a fair summary?
I think that's an absolutely fair summary. But let me just say, I'm just disgusted as you are. It is offensive. It's absurd for them to be getting these bonuses. To me, the larger issue, though, is whether you can rip up the contract. That's not to say we shouldn't try to shame them into volunteering to renegotiate the contract. We shouldn't be pressing these people to give back the money if they'll do it voluntarily. But what gets me very nervous, and I think should get a lot of people nervous, is if Tim Geithner and if the president say, you know what, we're just tearing these things up wholesale.
All right, I'll deal with the contract thing in a minute. Let me just push back on the employment idea. The notion is if these guys don't stay at AIG and are incentivized with these bonuses, that they're going to go somewhere else and maybe trade against AIG. That just sounds like extortion to me.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. I think there is a level of extortion going on. But let me take one step back. These employees, and there's not a lot of them that are that important, but you do need the most talented people to actually stay. This idea that somehow these people are replaceable is actually not as easy as you think. Do you want to take a job at AIG? If you're one of a Harvard MBA, and you're one of these mad geniuses who actually understands these products, which frankly 99% of the world doesn't, otherwise wouldn't be in this place, do you want to take a job at AIG or do you want to take a job at Goldman Sachs? It's a serious issue. And so to find talented people who can actually step into this seat and actually take care care of the American taxpayer, because now we are shareholders in AIG, is a big issue. And so we need to figure out how we can actually keep some talented people around so we don't get completely gamed by Wall Street.
But what about public service? I mean, so, hey, I'm so talented, I need $3 million to be able to decipher
Listen, the numbers are ridiculous. I'm not debating you on the numbers, and I'm not even debating that they should be getting a lot less. What I'm suggesting is you create a huge problem when employers or, frankly, any contracts start getting abdicated just because we decide that we don't like them. John, if the folks who run your show decided that they weren't going to pay you what they said that you were going to get paid, you might have a problem with that. Now, admittedly,
a threat hanging over my head every single day.
Admittedly, you haven't destroyed the American economy just yet, but it is an issue. And the other piece is not every single person who ever worked at AIG is a criminal or participated or made the decision that helped bring this company down.
Yeah,
I
totally understand that. And, before we go, isn't there precedent for contracts being renegotiated or relooked at when circumstances change radically?
Absolutely.
Okay, quickly.
Absolutely. And they should have. And if they haven't, they're negligent in trying to renegotiate them. What they could have done, and this is a different issue, is they could have taken the company and put it into bankruptcy. Now, we could argue that AIG effectively
was suggestion.
Bankrupt, in which case employees would be like unsecured creditors. They'd get in line with everybody else.
One of the best parts about being on this show is you can have a lively conversation with people like Andrew Ross Sorkin, Chief Mergers and Acquisitions Correspondent for the New York Times. The argument for paying the AIG bonuses. Thanks, Andrew.
As disgusting as it is, I haven't made any friends. Thanks.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So we asked this question at the top of the hour. When banks don't compete for your business, who loses? We'll find out in just a moment after Mark Garrison gives us the headlines.
Thank you, John. We have breaking news we're following this morning from the African nation of Madagascar. The president is stepping down. He just gave a radio address to say he's handing over power to the military. There's been no response yet from the opposition leader. Opposition forces were occupying a neighboring building. The two men have been locked in a power struggle that's lasted months and left more than 100 people dead. In a major speech focusing on Iran, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown says countries can acquire nuclear energy for power, but only if they abide by the UN's rules.
Iran is a test case for this new philosophy of the right to civil nuclear power with sanctions for rule breakers. And let me be unequivocal, Iran has the same absolute right to a peaceful nuclear program as any other country.
Gordon Brown made the comments in a speech this morning. Iran says its nuclear program is peaceful for energy, but many reports contradict that. It's St. Patrick's Day, and President Obama will meet with Irish Prime Minister Brian Cowan at the White House today. The president will also talk with two Northern Irish leaders. They'll discuss the need to maintain peace there despite some recent violence. John and Farai.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
So remember the good old days of banking in America?
Well, if you wanted money, you had to go in the bank for when it was open for like 3 hours. You just stay in line, write yourself a check like an idiot. And then when you run out of money, you just go, well, I can't do any more things now.
Right.
I can't do any more
things. That's it, yeah.
That was it. And even if you had a credit card, the guy would go, ugh, and he'd bring out this whole chunk, and he'd write,
Yes. Oh, Christ,
you have to call the president to see if you have any money. And
it's all true, kids. You had to call the president, yeah.
Those were the old days, as described by comedian Louis C.K. on Conan O'Brien. Banks have a well-deserved reputation for inflexibility, and even with the proliferation of ATMs and longer hours, 28 million Americans do not even use banks at all in their financial life. Our guest Jennifer Tesher is here to discuss what it means when banks don't serve neighborhoods, and larger numbers of people are finding alternatives to banks. It's both a vulnerability and a form of innovation. Jennifer Tesher is director of the Center for Financial Services Innovation at the studios of public radio station WBEZ in Chicago. Jennifer, good morning.
Good morning.
So let's talk for a minute about what it means that 28 million Americans are either underserved or not really served by banks. They've given up on banks for what reason?
Well, I think it's important to note that some have given up on banks. More than half of them have had an account at some point in the past and have given up. But there's a sizable percentage of consumers who've actually never even interacted with a bank at all. I think there's a whole host of reasons why consumers may choose to go elsewhere. Banks don't provide a lot of liquidity for consumers who are living paycheck to paycheck. They need that money as soon as they get paid. But if they try to deposit their check in the bank, they're likely to get a hold placed on that check for a couple of days. And that's just not going to work when you need to make your rent payment or buy groceries.
Now, to get that liquidity, just for a second, to get that liquidity, people are willing to pay a lot up front, check cashing alternatives and other kinds of currency exchanges, correct? Does that make the population vulnerable?
It could, although all of the studies show that the majority of consumers that cash their checks actually do so at grocery stores and other kinds of locations. And in recent years, the pricing on check cashing has come down dramatically. Consumers can absolutely still get taken for a ride. But Walmart, for instance, started cashing checks a couple of years ago and has one of the lowest rates in the nation at $3. That's pretty darn cheap. And the fact is that consumers are often willing to pay more up front for the certainty of knowing how much something is going to cost than at a bank where there's often a lack of transparency around what the fees are actually going to be. So you may pay a monthly fee for the account and then unexpectedly get hit with a very large overdraft fee or some other kind of fee that you didn't expect. And again, for someone living on the edge, that can really bite into your monthly budget.
Jennifer, how does this play out across race? I mean, we're pretty well aware that there's not a lot of multimillionaires using payday loans. But in terms of racial demographics, what do we know?
African Americans and Latinos are absolutely overrepresented among consumers that aren't really attached to mainstream financial services. But I want to stress that this is an issue that cuts across racial and ethnic lines. In fact, we actually think that the consumers who choose not to use banks or have trouble using them have more in common with each other than you might think, particularly from a behavioral and an attitudinal perspective. Convenience is very important to them. Respect is extremely important to them. They want to feel comfortable where they're doing business. They don't want to feel intimidated. And these behaviors and attitudes really cut across racial and ethnic lines as it relates to this subject.
And it constitutes a real opportunity for people like Lutz Urrutia, who's the president of El Banco in Atlanta, who actually caters to underserved population, recent immigrants, mostly Hispanics. And here she is describing what El Banco branches look like, and it's not a traditional bank at all.
Very bright colors, murals on the walls, music that's traditional to many of the countries from where our customers come from, very big kids play area, access to internet, online PCs, access to phones, free phones, coffee, cookies area for our customers to come and mingle. It's very informal type of environment.
Now, I don't really know what the success rate of El Banco is in Atlanta, but that's certainly a different approach, Jennifer.
That's right. And Luz really is a tremendous innovator, but she's one of many. In the last 5 years alone, there's been tremendous innovation in financial services, really catering to this audience. And I would say the timing is great because this issue has really just been exacerbated by the current economic downturn. And I think that many of these providers see a real opportunity in the face of the crunch that we're in now.
Well, one of the things we've discovered is that people have strong feelings about banks. Listen to this voice.
I really don't think that we need an alternative to banks. I think what we really need to do is replace all the regulations that were removed by the end of the Clinton administration and the Bush administration and put them back in place. Those were in place so that we wouldn't have problems like we're having today. That's my idea.
You know, Jennifer, you talk about this idea that if there's no transparency on the fees, people do get nervous. They don't trust banks and are more likely to go to Walmart where the numbers are clear and you pay them straight up front. What should banks do to get rid of this reputation that they are kind of unregulated money houses that are running around taking extraordinary risks with depositors' money?
Yeah, I do think that this is a very difficult time for banks, and they really have a black eye at this moment. I actually think there are three really important things they can do for their existing customers and for people who they might be trying to lure back. One is to help create a roadmap for customers during this uncertain time. People are hungering for financial advice and guidance. You know, 25 years ago, you'd go to the bank, you'd sit down with your banker, you'd have a discussion. Is this the right time to get a car loan? How would I do it? How would that loan work? Those kinds of conversations don't really happen anymore, but there's an even greater need to have them, right? Because people need financial advice, especially during these uncertain times. So helping consumers to understand where things are headed and how they can get their financial house in order would be number one. I think number two is to help people start to save money. I know it sounds crazy during these times where people are trying to stretch every last dollar, but part of the problem we've been having over the last 10 or 20 years is that the American consumer has spent a lot of money and hasn't saved any. And if you don't have any savings when your car breaks down or some other emergency comes up, it becomes a major crisis. So helping people to just put aside a little bit of money, I really do think will help improve their confidence and help the bank regain confidence in these consumers.
Well, the savings rate is up in the last few months, an indication of the crisis at hand. Also, the idea that one-on-one banking is an innovation is an indication of how far we've gone from the neighborhood idea of banking. Jennifer Tesher, thanks so much for joining us. She's director of the Center for Financial Services Innovation at WBEZ in Chicago. And for, you know, in honor of St. Patrick's Day.
Everyone is Irish.
Yeah, we found someone who we're just going to give him a shot here. What do you say?
Yep.
Jim?
If you missed anything, we're always on here at The Takeaway. Take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes.
Say podcast again.
Podcast.
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 Podcast. Okay,
podcast.
Go ahead. Yeah, please. Continue.
And here's your takeaway.
They're trying to put together a financial rescue plan to get credit moving in this country. And so for every minute that these people are spending trying to address the anger on AIG, they're not doing these other things.
That's Jackie Combs, New York Times national correspondent.
There's an L in there.
Combs. I say Combs.
Combs. All right. All right. Okay.
And here's an idea from a listener.
AIG, the awfully inept gang. How about if all those people take their bonuses and then put half the bonuses back into the company? Wouldn't that be a good idea?
A good idea there from a listener?
Kind of a stimulus package there from the AIG gang.
That's right. He wasn't Irish. No Irish.
Are you sure? There's no Irish at AIG?
No.
Isn't that what the I stands for?
Maybe. Maybe now they could update their acronym.
Well, how did it work for you there on St. Patrick's Day? You want to do this every year? You want to
sure.
do this every year?
Yeah.
I think he's pretty good. I think we should keep him behind the glass producing this program. You're the Irish guy.
That's right.
Name?
Jim.
And I'm John Hockenberry.
Aaron Gobra. I'm Farai Judea.
This is the crazy, wacky takeaway here on St. Patrick's Day.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.